Hello and welcome back to the Cool Your Jets podcast. I am Michael Nania. It is 2:41 p.m. Eastern Standard Time as I record this on March 12, 2026, which means the New York Jets are now 4 days into free agency here. Plenty of additions, plenty of subtractions in terms of players leaving the team. We've done recaps the past couple days, talked a lot about what happened on day one, what happened on day two. And here today, we'll talk a little bit about what went on Wednesday, what happened so far here on Thursday, which isn't too much, but plenty to talk about here as free agency is starting to take shape. We're getting an idea of where the Jets are primarily allocating their resources in free agency, which holes have been filled, which ones haven't. What's sort of the strategy and the philosophy moving forward? How do these moves affect the draft? A lot of these things are coming into shape here now that we're a couple days into this, and we're starting to get a holistic view of how this veteran period of the offseason is shaping up before we eventually get to the draft. And obviously, there will be a lot of core players added there. I think that's where the Jets are kind of relying on getting some of their core building blocks. Because look, the Jets passed up on a lot of, or gave away quite a few of those last season with Quinnen Williams, with Sauce Gardner. So those are holes to fill. The Jets, you know, still don't have a lot of top end talent on this roster. They have plugged a lot of holes the past couple days, but they lack that ceiling raising talent at the top of the roster. You've Garrett Wilson, you could throw Breece Hall in there. And maybe your offensive tackles. And Minkah Fitzpatrick now, I think, close to qualifies, although he's on the close to 30 years old, but they need that ceiling-raising talent. That'll come in the draft. But let's talk about these past couple days, or this past day and a half since our last podcast, and recap some of the things that the Jets have done here as they fill out the rest of this depth chart. Most notable move to me has to be Dylan Parham, the guard from the Las Vegas Raiders. Left guard comes in to fill the spot vacated by John Simpson and Elijah Vera Tucker. I'm a big fan of this signing. They get him at 2 years, $16 million, up to $20 million. Guaranteed only $7.5 million. So this is a discount compared to John Simpson, who got $330. Those guarantees have not been published yet. But as for Elijah Vera Tucker, 3 years, $42 million for $21 million guaranteed. So a discount compared to those two guys. And I think he's a better value than both of them, because compared to Simpson, he ranked six spots higher among left guards on PFF's rankings last year, which, you know, take those, put whatever amount of stock into that you want. Take it at whatever, however small a grain of salt you would like to. But it is a nice tool for quantifying offensive lineman when we don't really have much else out there to do that. So on PFF's rankings, Parham last year was the 14th ranked left guard out of those who played at least 500 snaps. So that puts him as a slightly above average starter. John Simpson was 20th. Combine that with the fact that Parham is 2 years younger than him, and this is a really nice deal for the Jets. He's a guy who's trending up. First couple years struggled. Started a lot of games for the Raiders. They threw him right into the fire there, and he got some experience. But year three, he was the number 10 right guard on PFF's rankings in 2024. Moved over to left guard this year and finished 14th at that position. So this is a guy who's in the middle of his prime. He's trending up. The Jets get him for a pretty cheap deal for a starting guard in his prime, an above-average starting guard in his prime. And considering this is their pivot move from re-signing John Simpson or Elijah Vera Tucker, it's a tremendous value given the alternatives. And then to throw AVT in there, obviously AVT is the most talented of these three players, has the highest ceiling. He's elite when healthy, but he's only played 27 games the last four seasons. So it's a major risk to give that high a salary and that much guaranteed money over 3 years to a guy who, you know, we're not sure if he's going to be playing football in November, because three of the last four seasons he wasn't. And, you know, obviously we talked about this regarding AVT, I think on the last podcast or one of the last two, but you could say they were only, you know, two of them were triceps injuries. Those are flukes. He's generally durable outside of that. Maybe he'll be fine moving forward. But look, if he has another season-ending injury, it will be the fourth time in 5 years, or at least the fourth time in 6 years if it happens in his second year with New England. But at that point, when it happens, you can only blame yourself for taking that chance, because it's happened three times at this point in the last 4 years. But of course, he's on the New England Patriots, so he's never going to miss another game, and he'll make probably three All-Pros over the course of this contract. That's just how it works for these two franchises. But logically speaking, give me Parham on his 2 year, $16 million, $7.5 million guaranteed over John Simpson at 330, 2 years older, did not perform as well this past season, or Elijah Vera Tucker at 342, 21 guaranteed, a guy who's played well less than half of his games over the past four seasons. So really like this move. And with Parham, I just like the player from what I've seen so far. He's very athletic. This is a guy who ran a 4.93 at 311 pounds in the 2022 combine. The 10-yard split is the best aspect of that. 166 in the 10-yard split. That, for comparison, David Bailey this year, very explosive, very fast pass rusher from Texas Tech. 162 in the 10-yard split this year. So 0.04 of a second in the first 10 yards of the 40 behind a guy like David Bailey. That's how athletic Dylan Parham is. And he's a lot bigger now than he was coming out. He's listed at 334 at this point of his career. And that has been confirmed. He talked about it at a training camp last year, because there are some places where he's listed at 285, but 332 is the official number to correct that. And he verified it at training camp last year. So he's a big guy, but very athletic for that size. And from the little I watched of his film, getting into a couple games from the 25 season at left guard, very athletic. He's quick out of his stance. He's really smooth with his hips on reach blocks. I mean, there are times where he would get around a nose tackle, beat him to the play side, and seal him out of the play. Nimble in the open field, does a nice job of framing linebackers. So a really athletic player. And then pass protection, I would say he's about average. He's susceptible to getting beat. He's not locked down, but he's just fine. And at 2 years, $16 million, a guy who's 26, going on 27 years old, third-round pedigree, very durable, 64 games and out of 68 the last 4 years. You take that. And he could only get better moving forward, because you consider where he's coming from, a Las Vegas Raiders team that was a complete mess up and down the roster last year. You know, coaching staff to the talent on the roster, total mess, but especially on the offensive line. And the Raiders only had five, or out of the five qualified offensive linemen for the Raiders last year who played at least 500 snaps, Parham was the only one who ranked top 16 at his position. So that stands out. If you have a young lineman who is, you know, faring well statistically speaking, within a unit where he's playing next to a bunch of other liabilities, that speaks to the difference-making ability that he brings to the table, because offensive linemen directly work hand-in-hand, I think, more than any other pairs of teammates on the football field, because you know, you're literally next to these guys. There aren't a lot of other roles on the field where you are actually side-by-side with your teammates, directly influencing what's going on with one another. You know, you're passing off stunts to your teammates. You're taking on a pass rush rep, then you're passing it off and picking up a blitzer. You're communicating blitzes with each other. You're doing a double team and then climbing to the second level. All these things are, you know, so directly tied to the performance of two different players influencing one another that if you're playing next to bad teammates, it's going to make you look bad and your stats are going to get worse. So the fact that he still put up above average stats in a unit like this where every other starter was worse than him, speaks to the difference making ability that he brings to the table. So as solid as his numbers look right now, and they're not off the charts or anything, but this is an above average starter at 26 years old. As solid as that is, especially for the contract he got and relative to the alternative options, he should get even better in the Jets offensive line, where he's going to be playing next to much better talent than he was in Las Vegas. And you know, look, Geno Smith is still going to be the quarterback, so all the sacks that you could blame on Geno last year, he's still going to be back there. Well, I mean, we'll see if a rookie comes in or another veteran, but it's still not going to be a great quarterback. Coaching staff is still questionable, but specifically offensive line talent, he'll be in a better situation, and that only should improve his stats from where they already were, which already put him in a very solid spot in terms of value on the contract that he got. So Jets get that left guard hole filled up, but here's the problem that I have with how this is being talked about. This does not solidify the starting five, not in my opinion, or at least it shouldn't, because Josh Myers is not a quality starting center. He's not. He's one of the worst starting centers in the league, and that's not a slight on him and his place on the roster. That makes him a high-end backup. If you're the 28th to 32nd best center, that makes you one of the best backup centers in the league. That's the role he should play. That's the role he was signed to play last year, and it's the role that the new contract extension he signed still lines him up to play. It was not an expensive contract that they extended him to that, you know, should pencil him into a starting slot in 2026. Only $6.2 million guaranteed over 2 years. That's high-end backup money. So Jets should still go out there, find a center to compete with him or who can at least be an upgrade, or take one late day two, early day three in the draft. He needs some competition. And the Jets also still need depth. Chukwuma Okorafor, who was their backup tackle last season, his contract expired. He's a free agent. And they did re-sign Max Mitchell, but he's not a primary backup tackle. I think he's there for competition, and you know, he brings that versatility of being able to play as a sixth lineman, something he did well last year. They re-signed Xavier Newman at the guard spot, but again, he's not worthy of being the top backup guard or interior lineman. I don't think that's where you want him to be. Josh Myers is the type of guy who you do slot into that role, and you say, okay, this is about as good as we can realistically hope for as a primary backup interior lineman. That's the guy you want in that position. Someone else should be starting. So that's what both of those things are next on the list for the Jets. A center to push Myers for the starting spot, and also a tackle who's capable of coming in and being the primary swing tackle behind Olufashinu and Armon Membu. So Dylan Parham signing, I'm a big fan. One of my favorite signings so far for the Jets in this free agency period, which is saying something, because I do like the majority of the signings they've made here. Really all of them, realistically speaking. And I don't say that lightly, because I'm very willing to criticize free agent signings and the value of them. I've done it a lot in the past, and I like what they've done. One signing I don't like, maybe the only one I don't like, Cade York, kicker. Now look, he's not the penciled-in starter. I'm sure someone else is coming in at some point to compete with him. But given the circumstances here, the Jets had a kicker last year who missed one time all season. No extra points, one field goal, and it was a 50-plus yarder. He hit a career-long 58-yarder for you. He led the league in field goal percentage. It was the third straight year he led the league in field goal percentage. He's happy to be back home with the team he played, you know, the heart of his career with. And you don't re-sign him. You let him walk for a $4 million guarantee. And then your pivot is Cade York, a guy who was a fourth-round draft pick and still didn't make it to a second season with the team that drafted him. That's how bad he was. And for his career, four seasons in now, he's a 73% kicker and only 94% on extra points. this is your alternative to Nick Folk. And again, I get it. So a competitor's coming in at some point. They didn't sign this guy to a major contract or anything. I understand. But kicker is so cut and dry. I really don't understand when teams operate like this at the position. There's no scheme fit. There's no excuses or projection or anything. Can you put the ball through the uprights? Nick Folk can do that as well as anyone. He's proven that for the last 3 years. Give him $4 million in guarantees. Bring him back. The hole is solved. You don't have to worry about anything. Now, okay, you saved $4 million guaranteed with Cade York on a minimum contract, or $3 million compared to the league minimum that whoever the kicker ends up being will make. Okay, you saved $3 million. Well, guess what? Now you're going to lose three close games because you don't have a kicker who can make a clutch kick. It just doesn't make sense to me. I'm not saying kickers are so valuable as to, you know, the point where you should break the bank for them or anything, but Nick Folk didn't break the bank. If he got a contract, $6, $7 million a year, high guarantees at 41 years old, okay, I would understand. That didn't happen. It's $4 million guaranteed for a guy who was as near perfect at his job as any player in the NFL last year, and you toss him aside for this guy who is pretty bad at being an NFL kicker, to put it frankly. We'll see who they add to compete with Cade York, but there's really nothing about York's resume that suggests he should be trusted. 73% kicker for his career. He's been released multiple times already. He didn't even play in 2025 just because no team wanted him. It wasn't an injury or anything. He didn't play and get cut. He just wasn't on a team. And now this is who the Jets tab to replace a guy who missed one kick last year. So I've given the Jets a lot of credit for their free agency so far, but this is the type of stuff that boggles my mind, because it should be really simple at kicker. You have a guy who's good, keep him. That's it. But now the Jets are going to have to sweat out another kicker competition. Whoever wins is going to be bad, and he's going to get cut, and they'll have three kickers this year. That's how this goes. So, but I don't know. It's weird. Some fans might be like, you know, this is great for the tank. This is exactly who they should have a kicker. And who knows, if Nick Folk wasn't Nick Folk, Jets lose a couple games that they won out of their three last year, and they're picking first overall, and they get Fernando Mendoza. We don't have to worry about Geno Smith and all of that. So if that's the mentality with Cade York, okay, fine. But then why did you sign all these veteran defensive players? That is what really baffles me the most about this kicker decision. If the Jets were super conservative in free agency, and it was blatantly obvious that they want to tank this year because they want to position themselves for a franchise quarterback next year, then I'd be like, fine, save some money on kicker, lose some games, go get a franchise quarterback next year. But the defensive signings indicate that they want to win games this year. They signed a lot of players who are in either deep into their 30s or close to it. They gave out one-year contracts. They plugged a lot of holes. They want to win games. It's clear. But why would you get rid of a kicker who could help you seal victories? I don't understand. Sorry if this is too long of a rant on kicker. I'm very passionate about special teams play. That's one thing about me as a football analyst that you have to know. I'm passionate about special teams play. It's very underrated. It's critical in winning games, and it doesn't get enough attention, but I'm going to give it the attention it deserves, which also means I'm going to give it the criticism it deserves when necessary. And this is malpractice from the Jets. We'll see who they add. Maybe they draft someone late. Maybe there's another veteran out there who has a better resume than Cade York, but it's not pretty. It's not pretty. For once, we didn't have to worry about kicker for a whole season, and now we're right back to square one. Okay, kicker rant is over. What else do we have in the news here? We talked about Dylan Parham. We talked about Cade York. You had this Wink Martindale comment that came up. He did an interview with the New York Post, talked about his interview process with the Jets and how close he was to being the DC. I'll give you the quote here. This is what he said in response to how close he was to being the Jets defensive coordinator. Quote, "I think it was close. I've always respected and I like Aaron Glenn. He's a good dude and we think a lot alike on a lot of similar things defensively. But just to be honest with you, I think it was one of those decisions that was out of his hands and we'll just leave it at that." End quote. You could take that however you want. It seems pretty abundantly clear to me that it's a little bit of a hint that Woody Johnson was, in fact, involved in that process. And Aaron Glenn shot it down at the combine. He said that being the play caller was always his intention and that Wink was on board with that. And then he pivoted to Brian Duker. It wasn't the most convincing rebuttal, if we're being honest, even at the time. And now in hindsight, it just seems like complete nonsense. And it's not definitive or anything. You know, we still haven't heard any substantiated reports on how that all went down. But given the speculation that already existed and how the man directly involved in this is basically affirming that speculation as true, kind of seems like that's what happened. And look, I was not a fan of Martindale as a candidate. So I'm really not that upset with the Jets not landing him. I would rather have Glenn calling the plays, honestly. I think he has much more recent success as a defensive play caller than Wink Martindale does. And I think him being a play caller as a head coach is the best way for him to have any sort of chance of panning out as a head coach. Because look, the CEO thing completely blew up last year in historic fashion. So if he's going to succeed as a head coach, I think him calling defensive plays and thriving at that is the best chance for him to potentially make it work. So I'm honestly cool with Martindale not being the D coordinator. And where the Jets ended up with not only Glenn calling defensive plays, but I like a lot of the defensive staff hires. Offense is a different story. I've talked plenty about that. We don't need to go into those. But specifically on defense, I like him being the play caller. And I like the hires underneath him. So I'm okay with the fact that it didn't pan out with Martindale being the DC. However, if it is true that Woody Johnson nixed this hiring and forced Aaron Glenn to go in a direction that he didn't plan to go, that's not good. It's not good. And it's not necessarily news to Jets fans that, you know, ownership could be a little more hands-on than you would prefer. It's happened before. It's well documented. But it would only be further evidence of the Jets owner being a little more hands-on than you would prefer. So Wink Martindale story, that happened. Let's see. Anything else here that's worth getting into? I mean, a lot of the deals became official today. David Onyemata spoke. Minkah Fitzpatrick spoke, and both of them spoke highly of Aaron Glenn, as you would expect. Onyemata knows him from the New Orleans days that they spent together. Minkah knows Brian Duker and spoke about being excited about playing under him. He also said he expects to play some big nickel, kind of stay in that role that he played with the Dolphins, but he did admit that he doesn't know for sure what the scheme is like yet, so still remains to be seen how the Jets plan to use Minkah and just in general what this defensive scheme is actually going to look like. You know, we've speculated a lot. We've used the Lions as a model for what they could look like. We've put that 3-4 label on them, but Robbie Sabo has talked a lot about this. I think the 3-4 or 4-3 labels are outdated at this point in the NFL. No one is that rigid in the league anymore. You just can't be. In a league where every offense uses so many different personnel packages, with the most common of those being 11 personnel, which is a 3-receiver set, which means the vast majority of the time, against that package, the defense has to respond with nickel, which means you're not playing 3-4 or 4-3 most of the time in terms of that exact set as you're picturing it, with seven players in the front seven and then only four defensive backs. Most of the time, you got five DBs on the field in today's league, in a league that's heavily reliant on three receiver sets, but on top of that is also so versatile with the number of packages that are used. And within those packages, the tight ends are often receiving threats, and you have a lot of tight ends in the league who are matchup weapons, and you would like an extra DB out there to cover that guy instead of a linebacker. So in this league, with the current way of how things are played schematically, 3-4 or 4-3 is kind of outdated. And even, you know, in terms of looking just at what teams play in base defense, it's so multiple, and that's the buzzword around the league is, you know, multiple as an adjective. You know, a lot of teams really value that. You see every team kind of use a mix of both things. To me, ultimately, I think what differentiates defenses, and you could throw offenses into this too, but what differentiates schemes around the league is really the philosophy and the intent. It's how do we want to play? What types of players do we want to build around? What are the main goals of what we're trying to accomplish? You know, obviously the end goal is score points and prevent points on both sides of the ball. But what are the steps we want to take to get there? What is the style that we want to implement to get there in the end? And ultimately, on the road to get there, a lot of the packages and alignments aren't actually that much different. The schemes, the play calls, and things like that. But what is different is the type of players you employ, the philosophy you play with. Like, are we more of a read and react type defense? Like, I think that's what Aaron Glenn is probably going to emphasize a little more than someone like Robert Saleh, who's an attack, just downhill, one gap type of defense. So both of those things can work. We've seen examples of it being successful across the league with both different defenses. I think Vic Fangio with the Eagles kind of gives you a more of that old school read and react type of defensive approach. And then Saleh's led some great defenses with the Jets and the Niners, where it was, you know, pretty simple, four down front, wide nine, just pin your ears back and go. And if you have talent, that could be successful. So I think 3-4, 4-3 is a little bit of a rigid way to look at it and label it. We're going to see a lot of everything. We're going to see, you know, we're going to see a lot of everything. It's hard to even start listing it off because I feel like every defense, if you go snap to snap, the number of different looks and packages that you see, it just gets so extensive that it's hard to just put a label on what kind of defense is this. Is it 3-4 or 4-3? Even go back to the Lions a couple years ago, and Robbie has an article on this where that is plenty of film, you know, kind of X's and O's depictions and screenshots and things like that to show you how it was lined up. But there were four down fronts, there were 3-4 fronts, there was everything. So I think it's really rigid to label it that way. But philosophically speaking, I think an Aaron Glenn defense is more emphasis on the physicality, the read and react, as opposed to, you know, compared to what we just saw under the Robert Saleh era, which was definitely more speed, explosiveness, kind of just go, all gas, no brake type of defense. So I think we're bound to see a different defensive style, but it still remains to be seen exactly what that will look like schematically, in terms of how the snaps are distributed, what types of roles different players are playing, whether that's the safeties, the edge defenders. Still a lot up in the air, but I do think you get this consistent theme across the Jets' defensive additions and free agency of really those traits I just talked about, the physicality and the ability to kind of play your role and play with discipline within the scheme, whether that's Demario Davis, David Onyemata, the two edge rushers they got in Joseph Asai and Kingsley Enagbare, Minkah Fitzpatrick, Nation Wright. I feel like pretty much every guy I just mentioned, you can praise their run defense and their tackling and their physicality and just in general, like two-way ability and the ability to not just be a pass rusher or not just be a coverage guy, but look, I'm going to be disciplined in my run fits. I'm going to make tackles. I'm going to contribute near the line. and then I'll get back and I'll play coverage, or then I'll go rush the passer once I read it's a passing situation. That's a theme I get across all of these additions. Along with the versatility aspect, you know, the two edge defenders they signed, both of those guys have plenty of experience dropping back into coverage. They obviously can play the edge. They could do it standing up with their hands in the dirt. And I've seen both of them play four-eye technique reps inside of the offensive tackle. Minkah Fitzpatrick's versatility speaks for itself. So those are some of the common themes across these additions. Our versatility, run defense, tackling, physicality, kind of sound, disciplined play. And I think those are the type of words, the type of traits that are going to encapsulate Glenn's defense more so than, hey, this is a 3-4 defense, this is a 4-3 defense, or however you want to label that. So what are the downsides of that? I think that's an interesting question. To me, I think the main downside is the lack of ceiling-raising type of play, because when you're valuing all that stuff that we just talked about, what are you not valuing? Or what are you not valuing when all those other things are the priorities? What's taking the backseat? Well, that would be some of the solid stuff, the aggressiveness and the explosiveness, the speed, the go make plays type of mentality. That's what is kind of taking a backseat. And, you know, that could put a ceiling on your defense. It, you know, as the Jets are currently constructed with the players that they had, the players that have been added, using all of those, using the makeup of the roster as an indicator of what the defensive philosophy seems to be, there is a lack of that, you know, kind of oomph to the defense, especially in the pass defense, because, you know, where's the pass rush juice coming from? And look, they're going to use the second overall pick on probably Arvell Reese, but maybe David Bailey, maybe Reuben Bain, although he feels like he's kind of out of this conversation, but they're going to get a premier high-ceiling pass rusher at number two. They still have Will McDonald, which we'll see where he fits in, which that's a whole nother conversation. I did a whole article on that. So, yeah, the roster's not complete, and I'm not saying the fact that this roster doesn't have great pass rush talent right now means the Jets don't value pass rush, but at the same time, if you build up your roster with that mentality of, you know, we care about stopping the run, we care about gap discipline and things like that, I think it does kind of devalue, like, you know, the ability to go get strip sacks and go get interceptions and go get tackles for loss and some of those big plays that ultimately do define the best defenses in the league. You know, at the end of the day, the defenses that win championships, win division titles, and have success are the ones that get a lot of takeaways, get a lot of sacks, and make those plays that really change games. And that's what I guess my concern with the defensive philosophy is. And I'm just saying this to kind of give like a balanced review of it, because I feel like you could sit here all day and say, oh, Aaron Glenn's defense values tackling, discipline, physicality, and, you know, all these things, and kind of paint this picture of it being perfect. But the reason there are different philosophies in football is because they all have their positives and negatives that balance each other out. If there was a single philosophy that worked perfectly and was obviously the best way to play defense or play offense, everybody would do it. But that's not the case. And I think that's what's beautiful about football, is that there are so many different philosophies to go about trying to win games, and they all have their pros and cons. And every single one of them has examples of teams that execute it well and examples of teams that execute it poorly. And that's why we get so much differentiation in terms of how teams approach the game. So that's really the point of this conversation, is not to criticize the philosophy or anything, because I actually like it. And I think it's a good foundation for a Jets team that's really trying to raise its floor and start trending back towards being a competent organization that can win games, compete for playoff spots. I think it's good to have a defensive approach like this, where they're starting to really value the fundamentals and the meat and potatoes of football. And Robbie talks about this all the time in his clips. It's a big reason why he's a huge fan of Arvell Reese, especially in comparison to David Bailey, and has actually convinced me to hop over to the Reese train, but it's something Robbie talks about all the time. It's just those fundamentals, is how to be a football player and doing the little things to help out your teammates and put the team above yourself. And Reese excels at that. Bailey does not on his film. And just in general, looking at the players the Jets added across their defense, I think they got a lot of players like that. So it does help to raise the floor of the team and kind of improve the culture from the standpoint of on the field. You know, I think people talk about culture in terms of, you know, having leaders and rah-rah guys and press conference quotes and all that, but it's what happens on the field that sets the culture. So I do think this type of defense is great from that perspective of really establishing that team first style of football. So I'm a huge fan of it from that perspective. But on the flip side of that, acknowledging that there is no perfect scheme and this is not one of them, my concern is, you know, is it a little too run defense centric? Is there not going to be enough pass rush? Is it too reliant on the blitz to get a pass rush? I think that's a question, because we know they're going to blitz a lot. They did last year. The Lions always did under Aaron Glenn. So they're going to be a heavy blitz team, and Glenn's going to count on his own scheming to create pass rush. But, you know, a lot of the best defenses or pass rushes in the league today aren't necessarily the best blitzing ones. It's often the teams that just really allow their pass rushers to pin their ears back and go. You look at the Texans last year under D'Amico Ryans, a very similar type of scheme to what Robert Saleh ran with the Jets and currently does with the 49ers. I feel like Denver was similar. And there are some high blitz teams that also are great in the pass rush, Minnesota being a prime example of that. And even Detroit from Glenn's final season. But I guess this is all just to acknowledge, you know, both the positives and potential negatives of the defensive philosophy the Jets seem to be embracing based on the additions they've made to the roster so far. So we'll see how it all plays out. Still a lot of uncertainty regarding what the scheme will look like. But I do feel like we've gotten a pretty good idea of what some of the core philosophies are. And I think those core philosophies are excellent from a floor-raising standpoint, and especially a culture-setting standpoint. My question is whether it might be a ceiling-capping type of scheme, because it does have heavy emphasis on things like tackling, run defense, which, you know, it's the bread and butter of football, but, you know, at the end of the day, those aren't quite the things that get players drafted high and get the big bucks. It's, you know, getting interceptions, getting strip sacks, getting tackles for loss, the big splashy stuff. So can the Jets produce that alongside defending the run well and tackling well and playing discipline? That's what I guess my question is as we watch this defensive system unfold. And a lot of that has to do with talent, which the Jets still don't have much of. They filled a lot of holes and raised the floor, but it's the top end talent they're still looking for, and they're going to get some of it in the draft. So we'll see who they end up with and whether those players can deliver some of that ceiling raising impact that I'm talking about. But that'll do it for me here as Jets free agency starts to cool down. I think we've seen the bulk of the money spent and the players signed to this point. But obviously still some little holes to fill. We talked about competition for Josh Myers at center, more depth for the offensive line. There could still be a quarterback addition coming in. I think whether it's through the draft, a free agent, or both, Geno Smith does need to compete for this job. I don't think we should view it as him being the penciled-in starter, because it just wouldn't be in the spirit of the culture the Jets seem to, or apparently are trying to build under Aaron Glenn, to just hand him the starting job. It was different with Justin Fields, because even though I still wanted Justin Fields to compete for that job, I think a lot of people did, but at least you could justify the fact that, okay, Justin Fields was the high-ceiling quarterback on the roster. There was no ceiling in Tyrod Taylor or, you know, Brady Cook or anyone else who could have been brought in. Justin Fields had the ceiling, so they committed to him, built a scheme around him, and wanted to do the best they can to give him a chance of tapping into that ceiling. So at least you could give that justification, but Geno Smith is going to be 36 this year. He doesn't have that potential. So After the season he had last year, he should be competing for a starting quarterback job, in my opinion. So let's see if they add a veteran who is good enough to compete with him. Let's see if they add a rookie who's drafted early enough to be considered a legitimate contender to start. So I would add quarterback to that list. Wide receiver is an obvious one. I think at this point, it feels likely that the veteran market will be used just to fill out the depth chart before the draft, and that the Jets are counting on those top four picks to deliver their ceiling and their potential at the wide receiver position. So keep an eye on that. And let's see what else in terms of outside of, so we talked about offensive line, quarterback, wide receiver, defensively. Well, they got Nashon Wright to compete at corner. They got Dane Belton to be a penciled in safety. He can compete with Malachi Moore. You got two edge rushers in there to compete with Will McDonald. So they've created a lot of competition across these spots on defense. I think the defensive depth chart is in a nice place going into the draft, especially considering that you're expecting adding an edge rusher second overall. So defense is in a pretty good spot. Maybe some slot corner competition for Jarvis Brownlee would be nice, although you still have Quantez Stiggers in there who can compete for that. Maybe some linebacker depth, but you still have Francisco Maui-Noah, who you're hoping can improve and learn from Demario Davis this year, an athletic young player. So a defensive depth chart is in a pretty good spot, but it's on the offense where the depth is really needed. So that's where I expect the Jets to focus coming up. And will they add another kicker to compete with Cade York, who can't make three quarters of his field goals? That's something else I'll be keeping an eye on. And quick thing I'll float here, and I won't go too deep into it, but I do wonder, given the state of the wide receiver position, you know, the Jets still haven't done anything to address a position that did not have a player with 400 yards last year. Given that, could we see Carnell Tate at two? Just throwing it out there. Not vouching for it, not predicting it. Just pondering. That's all I'm doing. Because Carnell Tate at two, you know, look, the Jets signed two starting caliber defensive ends. And I'm not saying Joseph Asai and Kingsley Enagbare should preclude you from drafting Arvell Reese or David Bailey if you love that player. Absolutely not. But it does reduce the desperation, especially when you have another position where you do have desperation. So let's say, hypothetical world, maybe you agree with this, maybe you don't, but hypothetical world, let's say the Jets have Carnell Tate and Arvell Reese graded equally as overall prospects. They both play premium positions, so that is a tie right there. Then the tiebreaker has to go to, which position are we more desperate at? And right now, it's wide receiver. I think you could say that pretty comfortably. And, you know, there's depth at edge in this draft. And you could say the same for wide receiver. There's depth there as well in the draft. I start to forget how to talk once I get so deep into these podcasts. There is depth at both positions. But, you know, look, if they have these two guys graded equally, or maybe Tate even above, who's to say they don't have him above? Because he is a very special wide receiver prospect, at least from my perspective. You know, looking analytically at how he fares in a lot of the metrics that tend to correlate with NFL success, he is right up there with anyone in recent years. And he's in the company of guys who turned out to be NFL stars. Jackson Smith-Njigba, Ja'Marr Chase. These are some of the players who produced similar to him in metrics that usually correlate with NFL success. So I do view Carnell Tate as a legitimate option at number two. Now, personally, I would still go with Reese because I think he fits perfectly into what the Jets seem to be building on defense. And he is that high ceiling potential, you know, superstar difference maker that the defense lacks right now, in especially the front seven. You know, Minkah Fitzpatrick in the back end, I think for now you can consider him that, until or if he eventually falls off in his 30s. But, you know, you have a difference maker with him. But front seven doesn't have one. And Arvell Reese can be that. And I think he's a perfect fit in what the Jets seem to be building defensively. So he's still my both prediction and preference in that two spot. But that Carnell Tate idea is interesting. You pair him up with Garrett Wilson. I mean, suddenly this wide receiver unit goes from a major question mark to, do we have the best duo in the league? They absolutely could be that. I think the two of those Ohio State guys together. So I'm just floating that idea out there. And look, you got 16th pick, 33rd, 44th. I'm sure you can get a good defensive end at one of those picks. Or you could package them and move up and make something happen. So offense is the core of winning in the NFL at the end of the day. And the Jets struggle to score points. They have for a very long time. And I think it's very likely they will continue to if their wide receiver depth chart is still Garrett Wilson and just a bunch of guys, as it has been for the better part of his four seasons, besides Davante Adams being there for a half season. So that's just an interesting idea to float out there. And look, we still don't know much about Darren Mooji and the Jets and this regime's philosophies and goals and things like that, especially after a season where they just basically rebuilt the whole coaching staff. So I don't think you could rule anything out in terms of the draft and their plans, because we're still learning about them and we're still learning about Mooji and what he prioritizes and how he looks at the draft. So that Carnell Tate at two idea, I think I've always had it in the back of my mind, but as we sit here now and wide receivers still unaddressed and the defense has gotten a ton of attention, especially at the edge rusher position, at least in terms of the quantity of bodies who are there, obviously no major additions and no superstars who fill the void that an Arvell Reese would, but just given the disparity between the defensive attention and the offensive attention, especially at wide receiver, it's an interesting idea. So I just wanted to throw that out there as some food for thought. You could chew that up, devour it, and you know, take that with you as your favorite draft plan for the Jets moving forward, or you could just throw that out the window. Maybe you skipped that whole part because it was so outlandish to you. Either way, you are justified because all of this is subjective, and that is what makes it fun to talk about football. Thank you so much for listening. Let's see what else the Jets pull off here in free agency the next few days, and let's start prepping for the draft. It's going to be a major one for the Jets. We say that every year. This is the biggest draft for the Jets since 1920, and then the next year is the biggest draft, and we just ignore that actually the previous year was the biggest draft. At least that's what we claimed, but it is fair to say that with four picks in the top 45, this is the biggest Jets draft since at least 2022. I think objectively you could say that. Maybe you could, you know, debate the two of them, but this is a big draft here coming up. And we've gotten plenty of information on the Jets' apparent philosophies, on their goals moving forward, on their depth chart, where the holes still remain, where, you know, they've potentially been filled. We've gotten some more information to inform our draft prognostications here. So going to be a fun process the next few weeks as we dig deeper into these prospects and have a little bit more clarity regarding who makes the most sense for the Jets team building plan moving forward. Thank you so much for listening. Let's see what else the Jets have in store. Have a great rest of your Thursday, Friday, or whatever day you're listening to this.